Welcome to BOGSCast, where faculty and staff at the Boggs Center on Developmental Disabilities explore best practice, showcase success stories, and help listeners envision possibilities for innovation through interviews with state and national experts. Part of Rutgers Robert Wood Johnson Medical School, the Boggs Center is New Jersey's University Center for Excellence in Developmental Disabilities and Leadership Education in Neurodevelopmental Disabilities Program. I'm Jamie Zahid, a training and consultation specialist here at the Boggs Center. In this episode, we'll be discussing how we can move towards an authentically person-centered system of supports and services for people with disabilities. I am joined by Alex Bonardi and Kate Brady, both of whom are from the Human Services Research Institute, HSRI for short. Alex Bonardi has over 30 years of experience with home and community-based services for people with disabilities. She is the IDD team lead at HSRI and has grown the National Core Indicators work, elevating participant voice and experience in state-level quality monitoring of HCBS for people with IDD. Kate Brady is project manager for NCAPS and HCBS setting rule engagement, and is particularly excited to grow community response to publicly funded systems of support, such that they better fulfill with HSRI's goal of seeing all people live healthy, fulfilling lives as powerful, respected members of society. Kate and Alex, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us today. Well, me. I know I give you both a brief introduction. I feel like people, for the most part, typically introduce themselves a little bit better than a third party can. I'm hoping that you guys can just take a few minutes to introduce yourself. And for myself, I'm particularly interested in what brought you both to this type of work.
I can take that question, I guess, to start. This is Alex. I came into this field, actually. I'm trained as an occupational therapist and did my training as an OT in New York and worked for several years in New York City. That training and working with people had me both really grounded in identifying really person-centered solutions for people. I was working directly with kids and adults with disabilities and both in the public school system and then in people's homes. And I loved that work. And I was constantly wondering about what factors led to people having really different experiences of just access to services. And so that kind of got me, turned me in on a different path, and I've been working really in the policy side of disability supports for a couple decades, I guess. So I mean that's really my background, and that's where my passion comes from too, is that I'm really interested in making sure that that everybody's got the access that they should.
Awesome, thank you so much for that, Kate. Can we go to you?
Sure. So this is Kate. And I think my passion has always been rooted in a sort of justice and equity anchor. I think I came by that as a kid, maybe just in my personality, but also just as a kid using a wheelchair and being in a public school system that, you know, in a variety of ways was responsive and in other ways was not. And also growing up in a pretty diverse neighborhood. I grew up in Philadelphia and racial inequity was not lost on me, even as a little kid. So I think that's a through thread in my career. I'm trained as an organizational and community psychologist. And I think I'm always thinking about systems. And most of my work for the past 20 years has been rooted in systems change as it relates to disability service systems. So I'm really interested in the interplay between policy and funding and values. And, you know, in NCAPS, we are really working exactly in the nexus of those things, recognizing that person-centeredness is a value that is necessary, but not sufficient, right? And that we have to align how we support people, how we fund those supports, and how we regulate and oversee. And so I've been putting a lot of work just recently into thinking about the home and community-based settings rule and the coming access rule, and recognizing there's always a gap too between our intent at the federal level and the ground capacity, right, in local communities. So I think that's another through thread of my passion, is just recognizing that we need to hear from people about their discrete hyper-local experiences to really understand what needs to happen in communities.
Excellent. Thank you, Kate. You're speaking to so many things right there with that one answer. Some topics we could have a conversation all day about, for sure. You mentioned capacity at the ground level, where people live. And that actually is one of the questions that I have prepared for both of you, is what about capacity? What to do when that capacity is not there? But we'll get to that shortly. I try not to use acronyms, and I introduced the two of you using the NCAPS acronym, NCAPPS. So I'm hoping that we can start with that. Can we talk a little bit about what is NCAPS? What does it stand for? What is the mission and purpose of NCAPS?
This is Alex. Sure, I can take that. And like you, Jamie, I try not to use acronyms, but when I say all these words, hopefully you'll forgive us for using the acronym NCAPS. NCAPS stands for the National Center on Advancing Person-Centered Practices and Systems. And over the last 5+ years, we've come to affectionately know it as NCAPS. And I know it's not exactly a household word, but it has come to roll off our tongues, I guess, pretty easily. The purpose, as the center was designed, we've got a lofty goal, and that is to promote systems change that makes person-centered principles not just an aspiration, but a reality in the lives of people across the lifespan. Super broad, right? And we came to this center through an opportunity that we had. This is a center was funded by the Administration on Community Living and Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. So that's ACL and CMS, if you want those acronyms. But this was put together as a concept, really, gosh, well, our funding started in 2018. Or at our organization to really launch the center. And what's kind of neat about it is that it is very broad in its conception, in that it is focused on advancing person-centered approaches that support people with disabilities in their lives. It is a cross-disability center. So we work to advance person-centered practices in aging and Alzheimer's and dementia supports. And also we've done efforts that have really focused on children and youth and families and developmental disabilities and people with brain injuries and physical disabilities. And so it's actually been a pretty far-reaching center. So that's really what our purpose is. Our main area where we do our work, we start with focusing in on supporting states, tribes, and territories to accomplish that work for systems change. And then at the same time, we've put a lot of effort over the last years in putting together publicly available materials and resources, which are on our webpage, and also then providing learning communities that are topic specific. So we're kind of broad, but always driven by moving systems in the direction of being more person-centered. Some of our priorities, just to hit on those quickly, is, as we were starting to talk about, is to be dismantling structural inequities that exist so that people with disabilities experience access and are able to access the lives of their choosing in their community, and that structural inequities are actually addressed so that people don't experience some of the marginalization that that exists across our society. We're also very much about cross-system collaboration. So when I say cross-system, there are like a lot of states have very siloed systems delivery, depending on how people come to the system. And we really believe that cross-system collaboration works well. We're really very much about making sure that lived experience is centered in the work that we're doing. So we work hard to make sure that, for example, when we do webinars, that the people with lived experience of disability are in the presentation, in many cases leading the presentation as well. And so, I mean, that's where our work lies. And after having a five-year cycle of the center, we're in sort of a one-year bridge, which we hope and intend will lead us to another cycle, funded cycle, in coming years.
Excellent. Thank you for that very informative response. I actually had the privilege of being part of one of the most recent learning collaboratives and really enjoyed the opportunity not only to work with a team of people from New Jersey and people that, you know, I've interacted with before, but didn't necessarily have the chance to really sit down and say like, hey, what's going on here? How can we fix this? And come up with a sort of a plan. And some of those plans that we came up with are in action now, which is exciting to see. And I hope that the long-term effects of that are going to hopefully cover some of those inequities that you speak of. Because for sure, access to the system is sometimes difficult for people to navigate. And, you know, you mentioned inequities, and it does boil down to that for sure sometimes, that there's, you know, just limited, you know, information or misinformation or whatever that makes it difficult for people. So thank you for that. This was not one of our prepared questions. And it's a question I'd like to think I know the answer to it myself, but I'm hoping that one of you ladies wouldn't mind, just for our listeners who keep hearing us talking about person-centered, so person-centered planning, what does that mean? What does that mean functionally for people that might be listening, who might be family members, might be service providers?
Right. Well, I think it can mean a number of things in the context of publicly funded social services, right? Those services that you might be getting from a provider or from a Medicaid waiver to help you do your day or help you live in the community or find a job or go to social things that you want to go to. The person-centered plan is a tool that lets you figure out and identify and then document what you want from your life, right? What's important to you and what's important for you and how those services to happen and with whom, who you want helping you and when and where. And it, as a document, as a process, should be a process that you control and that you have a right to in concert with the services that you get. And you have a right to that every single year and to involve whomever you want in that process. And that plan ultimately drives how the services happen. Outside of the context of funded services, we recognize person-centered planning can just be a great tool to think about who you are and what's important to you and where you want your life to go. And it might be happening not in the context of getting help. It might just be happening in the context of, you know, what do you want to do after you graduate from high school? And where do you want to live? And what kinds of things might you need to help that go really well? And so it's both a tool for the public system and a right that you have as a recipient of supports, and a really neat way to think about your life.
Yeah, you've captured it, Kate, and the couple other kind of concepts that are really related to person-centered planning, and I think are important to bring into the conversation, is person-centered thinking, which is really just the foundational principle that the person and their loved ones are the experts in their own lives, and that that all things should flow from that expertise and what comes from that. So that really is person-centered thinking. And as you'd mentioned, Kate, the person-centered plan really is a process, or like a method for coming around to identifying and getting to some clarity on what really is important and how people want to live and then drive their services. And then person-centered practice is the other term that we use. And that person-centered practice is really aligning services and supports so that people can live the life that they've identified. So there's sometimes our colleague, Michael Small, I think he uses the term a person-centered plan that is not implemented, you know, in a full way, actually does harm, right? Because it's like making promises that may not be kept. And the person-centered practice part is really what's so critical. And like the little example that I have in mind from someone I know where as part of the plan, they had identified that they really wanted to be more active and that swimming was something that they wanted to be doing. And as part of that, all right, we have a swimming pool that has been identified. People are going to, you know, line up to get support, to get somebody, to help somebody get to a swimming pool. But the pool hours at that particular pool were like crack of dawn morning. This person's not a morning person. And in that experience, right, the practice, that there were actually other options, but it was mostly the service provider that found this most convenient to get someone there early. And that was like the opposite of a person-centered practice. So like little things like that, just keeping going with an emphasis on making sure that the person's needs and whether they're a morning person is all part of the decision about how things get set up to support someone.
Excellent. Thank you so much for that illustration, Alex. I appreciate that. And Kate, I really appreciated how you you captured the fact that person-centered planning can be within the context of receiving services and also not. I'm always, when I'm training professionals and people and families, I like to drive home the fact that, and I've only had this realization in the past few years, that this is not disability specific. It's really not. This is about people, like just having lives. And of course, within the context of the work we do, it's disability specific and important to recognize the importance of making sure that we're applying it to people's lives who are receiving services. But truly person-centered planning is I think I'm paraphrasing. Kate, you said just about like living the life that you want for yourself. Mm-hmm. So in New Jersey, we've done a lot to promote person-centered planning and practice. What do you think a person-centered system looks like and how might we get there? I know that's a really big question.
It's a big question, Jamie. And we've got some ideas. I don't think we've got all of the ideas because if we did, boy.
We could just snap our fingers.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. So in answer to the first part of your question, Jamie, I would say a person-centered system starts with person-centered thinking and the recognition, like I said, that the person is and their loved ones are the experts in their own lives and that they are the ones who are identifying the life of their choosing and the supports should flow from there in when we're talking about a system of supports. So that would be the first step. It needs to include person-centered planning, which follows along with the person-centered thinking. And the one thing we haven't mentioned yet is that person-centered planning is an opportunity to, people can be really supported in person-centered planning by people who are skilled facilitators to help with that plan. And that was one thing we've learned early on when we got into this work, we were getting a lot of questions from systems saying, well, who should be doing that planning? Who should be doing that support? And in the work that we've done, and again, this is cross disability support systems, the answer to that is it can be any number of people who are facilitators. In many cases, it might be called a case manager or a service coordinator, but doesn't have to be. But there are core competencies of that facilitator that really should be in place. And I do think that that is kind of one of the cornerstones of a person-centered system. There are competencies that are understood for facilitating and supporting people to describe what makes sense to them from a person-centered perspective. That's another resource that we developed through NCAPS. We don't need to spend a lot of time on it because it's on the NCAPS website. But I do think that we really need to turn back to making sure that the supports and the facilitators are absolutely, you know, aligned with core competencies. I'm going to turn it to you, Kate, because of course, to the point of having a plan that doesn't get you there entirely, but I just wanted to see if there are other thoughts you've got, Kate, about that.
Well, thanks, Alex. I think you've covered sort of the foundational requirements, right? Having those person-centered thinking values, recognizing how critical it is to have skilled facilitators, and we do have the competency domains for person-centered plan facilitators that I think are so critical to implement across the system. And I guess the only other thing I'd add that I think we see in practice in our technical assistance work is that the system has to devote the energy to changing and aligning person-centered services, right? So when we say person-centered thinking, planning, and practice, it's those funded services and lifting up options like self-direction and individualized community-based services that are nimble and allow someone to go to whatever swimming pool is open in the afternoon and have someone that is equally excited to be at that pool in that neighborhood at 2 o'clock in the afternoon is really critical for the system to sustain itself as truly person-centered.
Excellent. Thank you, Kate. And Alex, I just wanted to touch back on real quick. You mentioned that the core competencies for facilitators of person-centered planning can be found on the NCAPS website. Was that correct?
That is right, Jamie. Yeah. And just a few breadcrumbs there. The NCAPS website has a tab called Resources. It's right in there, along with a bunch of other resources that we've developed or resources from our partners.
Excellent. Thank you. And I hope that listeners check that out, because it sounds like it could be a really helpful tool for doing person-centered planning and for holding people accountable for doing person-centered planning well, which leads me to my next question for you both. How can families and people with disabilities be more informed of what a person-centered life looks like for them? And how can they hold the system accountable for ensuring that's what they're getting from services and supports?
Jamie, I love this question. Kate, both of us are probably brimming with things to talk about.
You go first. Yeah, it's a great question.
It's such a great question.
Yeah.
And, well, one of the things I wanted to say is that that you've hit on really one of the core tenets of NCAPS as we were developing this, because we recognize that both if systems are really going to change, there needs to be pressure from what we call sometimes the top down, right? So that could be policy changes and restructuring of how services are delivered or funded or authorized. And there also needs to be the bottom-up demand coming from people and expectations about a service delivery system that is truly person-centered. So we've been really interested in working on both fronts, because that kind of pressure is what we think is really going to help drive systems change. So the quick answer, I just have one thing to suggest, and Kate, you might have other, or I'm sure you have others. I've mentioned the NCAPS website already. One other resource, which we're pretty proud of, and this is an opportunity for families just to get a little bit more of a sense from multiple perspectives. We have a series of videos called NCAPS Shorts, and they are short YouTube videos that were created by a whole range of people with lived experience of disability talking about what person-centeredness means to them directly. And I feel like they're short, it's worth going back to, and I've been back to them several times, and spending time directly hearing from people who've put some thought into what person-centeredness means to them, I think it can be a real opportunity to get kind of sparks of, oh, that would be the kind of thing we'd look for. That's one thing.
Excellent. Thank you, Alex. I knew about the NCAP shorts, and I'm going to admit I kind of forgot about them. So I'm glad you reminded me. Kate, did you have anything to add to that?
Sure. That Culture and PCP short series is just phenomenal. I hope folks will take a look at that. I think the other thing I'd like to add is just to encourage listeners who might be people with disabilities or family members that this is something we're working at the system level because we know systems have drivers that interrupt an intent to be person-centered. But for individual people, you may also have experienced interruptions, and you may also have been in a school system that sort of cues an interruption to your instinct, that schooling ought to be person-centered for your, young person with a disability, and that you do instinctively know when you're being respected and listened to, and when you're driving your own life. And it's those external drivers that interrupt that experience. And so I would just call folks to trust those rooted feelings and know that you functionally do have those rights, right? I mean, that we have embedded these rights in the regulations around home and community-based services. We have embedded them in many developmental disabilities waivers systems, and there are resources to support you. There are protection and advocacy resources, there are DD councils, there's NCAPs. I think you can kind of carve out space within your own person-centered plan, and within your own tiny, hopefully, provider network to experience the system in a person-centered way.
Excellent. And I think both of you, forgive me if I'm mistaken, I think both of you mentioned expectations. And I in college, I thought I was going to be a school teacher for a minute and took some classes on classroom management and whatnot. And what stuck with me from that and has carried throughout my work in the disability world is the idea of expectations and how expectations are going to be the driver of success. And we talk about that with children in school. And I've realized it's the exact same for the people that we are supporting who experience disability, that expectation is going to make a world of difference. You know, for somebody who grows up expecting to get a full-time job and go to college, they're going to actually realize that dream. And if you grow up with sort of limited expectations due to disability and the service system, then it's likely not to happen. So I'm glad that you touched on that. I hope that a takeaway for anybody listening is to have those, I hesitate to say high expectations. I think they're just typical expectations of your own life.
You've really hit the nail on the head there, Jamie. One of our colleagues who works with us on the NCAPS project, Nicole LeBlanc, also talks about how she says, I don't experience autism in a negative way. I experience the low expectation syndrome in a negative way. And that has been really something that I mean, her voice is so powerful, and I think she'd be okay with me sharing this because it's something that it's a strong message, and the low expectations, you're right, is something that can really be a barrier.
Yeah, because without that high expectation, you're not asking for what you want and what's going to make your life a full, meaningful life.
Yes. And I think it can be insidious too, right? The impact of limiting expectations over time can sort of interrupt our vision for how school might go, how transition might go, where one might live, how what work might be, what relationships might look like. And so there's a sort of vigilance that is required. You asked what can people with disabilities and family members do? And although it is unfair, I think there's a vigilance needed to anchoring in expectations that are rooted in what someone wants and loves, where their interests lie, and really holding fast to those, despite interrupting or limiting notions
I
that
love
might
that word
come.
interrupting, Kate. I'm gonna steal that from you and use that. You've used
Don't
it a few
steal it. I
times,
don't
and I
know where
love
I got it. what you feel, really.
Excellent. And sort of a closing question, and keeping in mind, and the three of us know this, that we can't put people's lives on hold while we wait for the system to catch up. So what suggestions do you have on navigating a system that perhaps doesn't quite have full capacity to do what people need to have a meaningful person-centered life?
You know, in this is NCAPS and beyond, just from my experience, I will say I've experienced and learned so much from the creativity that people bring to their lives when they kind of recognize that the service system is not really going to bring to me what I need. And often, in many cases, it seems like that creativity comes early, or that realization comes early. And then the creativity is, you know, what brings people, in some cases, some success. And by creativity, I mean just in terms of thinking about different ways to engage with people so that you can get support providers that, you know, are good and local to your community and work with you. And I hesitate to say, just be more creative. When people are really struggling with this, I recognize that it doesn't come off right. I'm just reflecting that in my experience, I've really observed that finding ways that are just kind of out of the box really seems like it brings people to life that they are most interested in. The one other thing that I'll mention is there are some ways of thinking about the effort and the impact that you're going to have as you're trying to move systems, and then also as you're trying to access things at an individual level. And the effort impact matrix is something that people can find online, but it is a way that I live my life. I think about how much work it's going to take to try and get to something, and have a really serious think with myself and others about whether that whether I'm doing something that is, you know, to use a metaphor, banging my head against a wall, or whether I really see I'm going to be able to make some change. Sometimes it's hard when you're in it and you're frustrated and you need to step back. But that's been something that I find helpful. I mean, that's at a systems change level, but also really an individual level too. It's just been a helpful way of thinking.
Excellent. Thank you for that perspective, Alex. Kate, did you have anything to add?
Maybe just re-mentioning self-direction as a powerful path that probably is available to most folks in some form or another, and in the framework of effort to impact, might be fruitful for getting folks out of the constraints of the system and into pathways that let you make your own choices about who provides support and when and how. And I can offer in my own life, I have found great success in hiring people to help me who are artists and who are creative folks and who are working on their own lives in creative ways, because they show up in my life in a way that presumes nothing. And that is a powerful place to start. And so I'll offer that as a personal experience of how I've used self-direction.
Thank you so much for sharing. And Kate, I feel like you nearly, I'm not exaggerating, you nearly took my breath away there when you said that they presume nothing. I was expecting you to say something completely different. You said nothing. And in that moment, I was like, wow, that is really powerful, because people do come into situations with so many preconceived notions. And sometimes that can be the blinders to what's possible, for sure. And thank you for that note about self-direction perhaps being part of the answer for people, you know, making their own way while the system tries to catch up. I know this is sort of full circle in our conversation then. The NCAPS cohort, the team for New Jersey, we did all of our work around how can we improve self-direction. And a lot of the stuff that we talked about was how can we improve access to self-directed services in New Jersey, because unfortunately there's been some systemic barriers there for us here in New Jersey. And so improving that through our NCAPS work is a sort of full circle moment here on this conversation, that I hope that people listening are utilizing self-direction and know that it's not an all or nothing when it comes to using self-direction. You can use self-direction in some facets of your supports and services and use provider managed in other areas. And it can, for some people, really make that meaningful full life. Did you ladies have anything else that you wanted to add to the conversation before we wrap up today?
Just to thank you for having us and letting us think about NCAP.
Me too. I've really enjoyed this conversation, Jamie and Kate. These kind of conversations really fuel a lot of energy to keep this work going.
Absolutely. My only frustration with doing podcasts is that I wish we could talk so much longer. I really do. I'm like watching our time, because of course our listeners are probably not looking to listen to us for 5 hours, but I definitely feel like I could have spoken to the two of you for a lot longer on all of this. Thanks for listening to this episode of BogsCast, a podcast by the Boggs Center on Developmental Disabilities. A full transcript of this episode can be found at theboggscenter.podbean.com. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on your favorite streaming service to stay up to date with the newest episodes. To learn more about the Boggs Center, visit our website at rwjms.rutgers.edu/Boggs Center and follow us on Facebook at the Boggs Center on Developmental Disabilities.